Welcome back to I2, where we open your eyes with new perspectives. Rodney H. Dixon is a CEO, entrepreneur, and author, among other things. He is the CEO of Street Legend Enterprises, a digital basketball coaching program, founder of Street Legend Rodney Dixon Global Business Network, a solo professional, author, and global marketer. Today, we get to know the man behind the story and explore how his creative passions built his career.
Welcome, Rodney. It's great that we could finally get you here.
Appreciate it.
I wanted to start by asking a little bit about you and your personal life. So what was it like for you growing up? You grew up in New York?
Yes.
You recounted it a little bit in your book, but it would be great if you could give us a little bit of an insight into what that was like for you.
Yeah, so I grew up in New York, but I moved to California early on. So and then I went back and forth between the both. So my dad lived in New York, my mom lived in California. So I traveled both, which is to your advantage because New York is really, really fast. It's high paced, a lot of aggression. California is more laid back. So you learned both styles because you kind of need both styles in the professional world. And then it kind of gives you a foundation to how to deal with different types of folks. And so as I ended up doing international business, I'm sure that background was to my advantage for that.
That's a really interesting way of seeing it. And I think a lot of us here in Australia would be quite jealous of the fact that you got to grow up in New York. One thing that I found really interesting, I sort of skimmed through the beginning of your book. You mentioned your cousin, that he was your hero, especially in the sort of hard time that you had when you were growing up. What was it that made him one of the key figures for you at such young age?
Well, one, he was older. So he was like in high school when I was like 7, 8 years old. So he was older and I lived with him. So that's one thing. When you're that young, high school is a real big deal. So, you know, for him to be able to go to high school, navigate, drive by himself, and you seeing all that stuff. And then he was a great student on top of that, a real, just a solid guy all the way around. So he became my hero for just his example.
Oh, this is the freedom that you sought. And you, in your professional career, you developed a real passion for interdisciplinary fields and also for solar energy, basketball. You've done quite a lot. Did you have such a passion for education and creativity when you were younger or in high school?
Yeah, it definitely started when I was younger. So I started out with a passion for reading. And so, and then listening, my mom bought me these, and I talk about this in the book, where my mom bought me these albums. So I'm dating myself now, albums. And I would listen to these albums, but they would be cartoon TV shows, but yet on vinyl. So you didn't see anything, and they would have the narrator and then the actors playing it all out. So it's not much different today where you have the top actors doing the animation stuff, but then it was just being done on a record. So as a result, it made you use your imagination as to actually what was taking place. And I credit that for kind of building up my ability to visualize things. And so I use that to my advantage to this day, where if I'm sitting in a consultation with someone about business or soul or whatever, I draw a picture. I make them able to see a big picture. And that came from, you know, way back then.
Yeah. Well, the all the art for your book and the albums that you've released as well are all comics. So that's a clear string of inspiration that's carried you through. What was your college experience like? Where did you go to college, and what degrees?
I went to a few colleges. So I went to a college in Maryland, and in my first year, that's where I met the artist Prince. So left college, started working with him. A few years later, checked back into a college because I was a basketball guy. So I checked into a college, became the number one college basketball guard in the nation, left that. My friend had gotten drafted by the Denver Nuggets of the National Basketball Association, the NBA. So I went over there with him, moved in with him, and started practicing with the NBA basketball team out of nowhere off the streets. And so they started interviewing me in the newspapers and stuff like that, saying, okay, the street legend has come to Denver. He came off the street. And then I, after that, went into a college, Oregon Tech University, and then ended up at Brandman University. So I've gone to multiple schools for various reasons.
What was the, like, those transitions? Obviously, you're moving out of home, you're young, you're wanting to explore. What was that like for you?
So the first one is exactly what you're saying. I was very young. So when I got out of school, my senior year, I was only 17. So I was very young when I got into my first year of college, but I was already being involved in the arts. So I was in acting classes and stuff like that in high school. One of the directors for the plays that I was doing was actually a Hollywood producer. And I had gone down to Hollywood a lot since the age 14, 15. My mom got me an agent when I was 15. So I was familiar already with the industry. So when I went to my freshman year of college in, you know, basketball, set up for basketball, when I met Prince, it was actually kind of a natural progression because I already had a background in entertainment. So it really wasn't that big of a stretch for me to go that route. I have multi talents, and that was just one of them.
Wow. And do you still keep in touch with any of your friends from college?
From different colleges, not from that one. Okay. So, yeah, not from that one. But the friendships I made in the entertainment industry, some of them guys are still, you know, active today. They're still in the entertainment industry. Of course, Prince is no longer with us. But some of the other people that I met are still in the industry. I don't do too much hanging out with people in the industry like that today.
Okay, well, that I think kind of segues nicely onto the next set about a little bit more about your professional work. So you had a really interdisciplinary background straight from the get-go. Really straight up, what is it like being a CEO? How did you make your first company?
So actually, I was like, I think I was 21. Wow. And a friend of mine, I started making music and creating the demo tapes and the music that Prince would use. And so I knew that I needed to have a structure connected to that. And so I asked a friend of mine, George, to do a corporation for me. And he was a few years older, but was very astute in business. And so he brought me over a packet, and I thought it was the corporation that I asked him to do it for me. But he handed me this packet. When I opened it, it was the instructions of how to do it, how to do a business plan, how to do a corporation. So he didn't do it for me, and he got me the instructions. So back then you couldn't just go to the internet like you can now. So he went through some channels to go and get all the paperwork to get it to me. And so I was like, oh man, you didn't do this. You didn't do the corporation, man. And he goes, hey man, if I do that for you, you'll never learn how to do it. So that started me on my way. And from there, I would start building out business plans and all. And he and some of our friends that were more astute, older than me, would actually look at the paperwork, and they would keep saying, ah, no, that's not good enough. That's not good enough. I would get frustrated and irritated. And then eventually I put one together a few years later, and they all looked at each other in silence, and everybody was kind of, you know, reading through it. And then about 10 minutes later, they go, man, you finally arrived. And so from there, I knew if I could get those dudes to give me a thumbs up, I had it going after that.
Oh, wow. And did you have any idea that you would like have a like successful business?
Oh, yeah. From there, once they showed me what business codes were, how to read business codes, legal codes, paperwork, you know, that everything is based on paperwork, how to build companies, you know, troubleshoot them, the whole nine yards. Once they gave me the blueprint, I knew from there, because once you have the blueprint, there's really nothing you cannot put together. It's just a matter of what is it that you want to do. But as far as the infrastructure and how to build it or put it together on paper, which is what you have to do, right? If you even want to get money from the bank, you got to have the paperwork tight. If you want to get an investor involved, you got to have the paperwork tight. So once I learn how to do the paperwork tight, then from there, it's just a matter of, even at a job, it doesn't matter. Whatever it is you get into, because of all that infrastructure and that foundation, you can pretty much do anything that you really want to do.
Wow. And it's amazing that you started so young as well. What made you get into solar energy and the different businesses that, like, the specific disciplines that you have worked with?
So solar came about first of all through the art. So I started writing about it. And that was because working with a guy like Prince, you know, solar wasn't something he was going to write about. He was writing about themes that I really didn't want to write about. Right. I'm more of a godly man. You know, that's how I'm inspired. And so to write about some of the stuff that he wanted to write about was not my deal. So the gospel music at that time was really kind of old school. So I'm 21 years old. So I'm going, OK, well, you know, the traditional gospel thing at the age of 21 is really not going to get it for me. So how do I kind of write about the themes that I wanted to write about, which is light versus darkness and stuff like that, and do it in a cool way and yet make it hip enough where young people would kind of dig it. So once I saw the sun and solar and all, and I go, okay, that's light, nighttime is dark. Let me start there. And so once I put those themes out there, Prince was like, what in the world are you doing, man? What are you talking about? And I kind of kept running with it. So he'd take it and flip it and put it into however he wanted to put it. But as far as anything that I created that I handed it to him, it was going to be solar related. And as I started, kept getting into themes and deeper into it, because of that visionary background, I started to visualize what this would be like, how this would play out from a business sense. And that's where everything else came to be. So basically, I was kind of writing about solar thesis and business plans as it related to solar energy from an artistic standpoint, which became the marketing foundation. I was doing that 25 years before there was a modern day solar movement that came into effect in the year 2005 in America with the Clean Air Act. I was doing that way before that.
So you prefaced everything that was to come.
That's right.
And what do you think of the modern solar movement, how that's going?
It's powerful. It's very powerful. It's unstoppable, but it's not moving as powerful as it could. And so there's a few reasons on why it's not moving as powerful as it could. Now, of course, there's some people who were against it. There's some big parties that need to get their, you know, get in the position they want to get as it relates to this alternative energy, right? They weren't necessarily, they didn't have their feet in the ground based on alternative energy. They had their feet in the ground based on fossil fuels and the old grid that's 100 years old, et cetera. And so if you're making money that way, you're not really looking for change pretty quick. So it kind of came about in a really interesting way that most folks don't know. And so that opposition made it move a little bit slow. And then two, solar companies oversimplified the pitch. They oversimplified it and they underestimated inquisitive nature of the human mind. And what that means is the skepticism that comes with, this is really gonna cost you nothing, it's gonna save you money, but it's not gonna cost you anything up front. And this is, you know, zero money out of pocket and it's making you money. And America and the rest of the world said, wait a minute now, that's a little bit too good to be true. So the too good to be true concept, that hurdle, right, that obstacle is the obstacle that kind of slowed the solar industry down. And these bigger companies didn't have an answer suitable for the average homeowner.
And when you, because you're in real estate as well, so are you involved in a lot of those conversations that are about the skepticism in using solar panels?
Exactly that. So my real estate background definitely plays into it because a lot of questions are about real estate. And then in all actuality, solar is almost a co-component of real estate because you're using property. So whether you put it on a roof or you put it on the ground, which you call ground mounts, it's still property. So it's still real estate, right? So it's real estate related. So there's a lot of principles of real estate that if you never knew the principles of real estate, you don't know what that's all about, then you don't know how to apply solar to it. And so a lot of people are just saying, oh, it adds money to your house, but they really don't know how to articulate the principles of real estate as it relates to solar to a homeowner and make it make sense because of the background I do. And then real estate people don't know how to do it on the solar side. So for years, it's kind of been a hit and miss concept between realtors and solar professionals kind of passing like ships in the night.
Missing. Yeah, I mean, it is a sort of complicated topic when you start to get into the complexity of that. And I mean, I even just a lot of that language is just going over my head. But I'm going to play a bit of devil's advocate here. I want to preface again by saying I'm not against solar energy. I think that it is a really positive, making a really positive effect on the environment, and it is a great way forward, but the technology does need to be improved. And I came across this in one of my university courses about the pollution caused by the production of solar panels, the disposal of solar panels, and then the sort of efficiency and the different types of solar panels relating to their efficiency. Do you think that those are things that makes people more skeptical to use them? Do you think that there are lots of people who are waiting for there to be better technologies? And do you think that those technologies are coming soon or in another couple decades?
Technology is improving every day. However, there isn't many. I've been involved with thousands of solar deals. So I don't even think there's been 1% of the people that we've ever dealt with where that becomes their obstacle based on the future of technology. Usually when you have a conversation and it's regarding the future of technology and people think that technology is going to get better, that's a belief based on economics. So they feel like if technology is going to get better, the panels are going to be more improved. And as a result, you'll need lesser panels or you'll need very small components rather than the big panels that are put on the roof. So people think about it from an aesthetics perspective, as far as the roof is concerned. And the other part is there a greater economic advantage in the future? Which when you start looking at the business of energy, that argument doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting. I think that's a really good point. I actually wouldn't have thought about the aesthetics. I'm not buying a house, so I don't think about these things, but I wouldn't have thought about the aesthetics of the roof.
Yes, yeah, people think about the aesthetics on the roof, and so that's not the majority of folks. It's definitely not, has nothing to do with the people that do go solar, but most of the people that don't go solar is because they don't get it. They don't understand the business element of it. And they don't understand the momentum as it relates to the governments and how it's being pushed, the big money that's going into it, and the position of the world as it relates to climate change. And so all these type of dynamics, the grid being rickety and old, the trillions that it'll cost just to, you know, to band-aid the grid. And then you start talking about attacks, you know, national security interest as it relates to hitting a grid and putting everybody in the dark versus having energy on your own and being off grid with batteries and things of like that. And that's a whole nother conversation, a whole nother level. So a lot of homeowners just really don't understand it. And well, I guess the other part of it is there's not a lot of solar grew faster. It grew fast, but not as fast as it should have, but it did grow fast. And so it's been great for hiring people to get into that business and have jobs and make money. But because of the simplicity of saying it costs nothing and to save you money, so go out and sell it, the training hasn't been very astute. For example, you can't get a real estate license just going out there saying, okay, I'm going to go out there and sell some people a house cheaper than the other house and get a license. You're not going to work. You got to go through a state exam. Whereas in solar, you can kind of get out there and not be very astute in your profession, not really understand how the dynamics of this stuff work. You really don't understand energy and the business of energy very well. And that's a part where you get some people out there that really just don't know how to articulate a very strong overall presentation to a homeowner, where a homeowner who bought a house, which is a big investment and pretty smart, the conversation is a little bit too dumbed down for the homeowners. They just say, okay, this is senseless. It doesn't make sense. You're not really articulating to me the intricacies of this. And as a result, it's too simple. I don't want to do it. You got to really take your time and know what you're doing and get educated on all the aspects of energy business. Companies don't want to spend that kind of time.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think that's something really interesting to think about, particularly as I know a lot of my listening group and a lot of my friends, we are thinking about in the next sort of 5-10 years of maybe investing in a house. So that's some really interesting points to think about. The last question that I have a bit about your professional career. You spent a lot of time dealing with royalty and celebrities in the Middle East. What was your motivation to branch to the Middle East specifically?
So it branched to me. So yeah, I was in Denver, Colorado with some friends. After I practiced with the Denver Nuggets and went to Oregon Tech, the next follow-up year, I went back to Denver, Colorado on a visit. And I ran into a friend of mine that I had met the year before when I was in Denver. I used to help him. He was a college student. I used to help him out. And some other college students were friends with him. And so he saw me and came over to me and introduced me to those students. And those students were from various royal families and astute business people from the Middle East. These were the kids. So they're 18, 19, 20 years old, basically college students in Denver, Colorado, when I met them. And so when I met them, I didn't know that they were royalty. I knew they had money. And so they basically just wrapped their arms around me. And I started to help them with small things, just how to go about buying cars in the United States without necessarily having a social security number and putting contracts together for them because they didn't have that. And then they started sending word back to Saudi Arabia. And then the older members of the family started saying, well, can he do this? And they would send over a business idea and ask me to build out a business plan or a feasibility study for this idea they had. And so I started getting into other members of the family that were higher up, and it kind of rolled from there.
Wow, that's amazing. You never know who you can meet just randomly walking by. Okay.
Right.
Ending on that note about students, I have some questions that are a bit more topical, a bit more related to advice that you can give from your experience. So what is your number one tip for student budgeting and investing?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. Like I told those guys, okay, so if I, the same advice I gave them is the same advice I would give today. They had a lot of money, but it didn't matter because midway through the month, they would have to go call home and get more money. They didn't know how to budget. And although the parents had ridiculous levels of money, the parents didn't like the fact that these kids didn't know how to budget their money. So it doesn't matter if it's a small amount or a large amount, if you're spending more than you have, there it is. So the amount really doesn't matter. Now, what they were doing, where they were eating out, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, right? The refrigerator was never opened. I took them to the grocery store for their first time. So my advice would be buy a grocery, stop eating out, right? Cut down on your cost of just wasting food out and about. That would be one. Two, if you're going to invest, start small, start on something, invest in you first, right? So if you can spend a little money to learn about something, learn about a topic that you're interested in, do that. And so I've had friends in college go, you know what, I'm gonna go out here and get my real estate license while I'm in college. And then when some of these other friends of mine come into this particular area, I'm the one that's gonna make money on the real estate, whether it's getting them rental houses or whatever. And so they're the ones who kind of put that together. And then some other friends said, okay, I'm gonna get my real estate license, start making me some money. And then I'm going to go and get these houses. And so four or five, six different students can come into the houses that I own and build money on those houses. So I just say, start thinking like an entrepreneur while you're in school. That would be my number one tip.
All right, what's a practical way that you can start thinking like an entrepreneur?
Reading. You gotta read it, you gotta start studying. You wanna study what other entrepreneurs are thinking. I'll give you an example. So there's this guy named Marvin Davis. Marvin Davis is no longer with us, but back then he was alive, and Marvin Davis is a multi-billionaire. So a friend of Marvin Davis had met one of the Arab friends of mine who was part of the royal family. And he found out that he was part of the royal family. So he wanted to set up a meeting with Marvin Davis. Now, of course, Marvin Davis wasn't going to be doing business with this 19-year-old kid from Saudi Arabia, regardless of who he was. However, Marvin Davis wanted to get in with this kid because of his family. So I'm talking to Solomon and I go, look, dude, if you start answering questions, that he's going to ask you questions to see how much you know, to see how much of a conversation he needs to have with you versus a very small conversation, a limited conversation, because you don't have the knowledge. So when he asks you this first question, stop him and tell him that you do business, your family do business based on people that they know and relationships. It's not just transactional. And so I want to know about you, and I can tell you about me. I said, what that'll do is that'll freeze him. And then he'll start telling you about who he is. That's the best education you're going to get, because this billionaire is going to start to tell you what makes him tick, how he thinks about regular things. Because how a billionaire sees a scenario, even though it seems like a regular scenario, they're going to see it differently than somebody who's not a billionaire. And Solomon did exactly that. And for the next hour, 2 hours, Marvin Davis starts schooling him on the mentality behind a billionaire. Solomon's cousin, Bandar, I did a feasibility study for them. And I think 2 years ago, Bandar became the number one guy in all of Saudi Arabia for the energy, like an energy minister. So it's you can get that same thing from reading books about these dudes and their childhood and kind of how they think, and then try to see how you think and compare it and start making adjustments about how you think about some things. That's where I would start investing, is on the mentality of thinking the correct way.
All right, so I'm gonna go out and buy all of my books now to help inspire me.
Right, not transactional books, right? So you can buy a transactional book. You can get a book on how to do a real estate transaction, and you do this paperwork and that paperwork. Okay, well, obviously the big boy who's making the real money, he's hiring a guy to do the real estate transaction. So you can go and learn how to do a real estate transaction, but still not really know how to be an entrepreneur, right? So I can get something where this guy is telling me where he was poor in his childhood and he started doing these different types of things, and he started doing these other types of things with his money. I'm not looking at the transactions, I'm looking at the mentality. How do you need to think? And if I can read four or five different guys who've done that and see that kind of universal thought process where they really kind of think the same way, that starts to, like the Robert Kiyosaki when he talks about rich dad, poor dad, how it was the difference of a mind shift, the difference of mentality that made the difference. You got to learn how people think that are there. When Kobe Bryant meet with people and he not only show them the moves, he also starts to talk to them about how he thinks. And then some of these players go, oh, you know, I really never thought about that. If I go to a gym, instead of going out to a club, he used to make sure that he would call people up front. And he built relationships with these gyms and these different places so he can always be on point and practice more than the next guy. Oh, wow. And so Kobe calls it the Mamba mentality, right? I don't necessarily like that term, but I understand the term and I understand what he's talking about in regards to it. The mentality is everything.
That's a really interesting perspective. And it is about changing your perspective to sort of be able to improve in your own field. I really like that advice. I think that's very topical, particularly for what we talk about here on our show. What is one of the craziest things you have ever done in college or school or your adult life? One of the craziest things you've ever done?
Wow, that I could say on this podcast. Wow. Okay. Well, one of the craziest things I ever did was I sued Prince for $1 billion.
$1 billion.
And the way I did it is I created a whole entire entertainment formula, right? And made a lawsuit fit. And so you had law inside of this creative world that I created. And I did it because I knew that people would question, if I'm suing this dude and he's multi-million-dollar, multi-platinum artist, they're gonna look at me and go, well, I don't think this dude needs to use what you have. Now, years later, everybody's now starting to do tell-all books about how much entertainment he used from them, how much music he used from them that they didn't get paid for. But when I first said it, people were like, oh, dude, he doesn't need what you have. And so I knew that people were going to do that. So I said, okay, this is what I'll do. Instead of doing a regular lawsuit, I'm going to create right in front of your face. And so I'm going to do this lawsuit based on all this creativity. I'm going to do it in such a grand scale. And then you'll see years later it come into play. And so you're going to have to give me credit because you're going to have to say, how did he know this was going to happen? How did he know that was going to happen? How did he know this was going to add up to this? I threw solar energy in it 25 years before it came about. And so all this creativity, and then yet at the same time with no attorney, fit all the legal aspects of it. And kick attorneys' butts up and down the place where they had to go running and for cover and doing all kinds of stuff. That was probably the craziest thing. But putting all that together and actually doing it and making sure that every point was covered, that nobody could kind of seep through and gain one point on me, that took some serious undertakings. So that's probably the craziest thing I've done.
That's insane. I couldn't even imagine. You're just painting like a whole story and then just, yep, do what you want with it.
That's right. That's right.
Oh my gosh.
And a lot of them still to this day, they don't get it.
Oh my God. You beat the system.
Yeah. They didn't want to give me the money, but it didn't matter. It didn't matter. I showed them. This is the level of my creativity. Don't come to me telling me that my creativity wasn't strong enough for this dude to use.
Oh my gosh. So on that note with like pop culture, what are your pop culture influences at the moment in terms of, I don't know, anyone on Instagram, a book that you're reading, a Netflix series, a movie? What's something that you think is really inspiring at the moment?
It's funny you would ask that because some friends of mine, we talk about solar all the time and what's the problem with the solar business. And a statement that I always say is that the solar industry does not know. They don't know how to make solar pop culture. So I don't necessarily have anybody in particular today that's in pop culture that's doing what I'm seeing and what I'm seeing needs to be done, because I deal in the energy game. And so I guess the closest thing, and these guys aren't necessarily pop culture in the US, but they are pop culture in their parts of the world. And that's those sheikhs. And I got relationships with a bunch of, and those sheikhs are pop culture in their world. They're the ones on the billboards. They're the ones with the magazine. They're so much pop culture that you can come into their world as a big time artist, and they'll pay you to come perform at their 10-year-old son's birthday party. You know what I mean? Like, I don't care how big you are. They're like, we can pay you to come to our living room and do a show for 15 people. So that's how big they are in pop culture. So when I see these guys as energy entrepreneurs and who they are in themselves, they're kind of the pop culture that I look at and say, because of that. And then I've seen some of the artists that I know, Prince included, how they react and respond when those boys come walking through the door. Because they know when those boys come walking through the door, they large and in charge, right? You got presidents just kind of like, oh, shoot. You know, shake faces here. So I see them and I'm like, all that
perspective.
That's pop culture. They would meet.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you so much for all of, like, answering all of my questions and giving all of that advice to my listeners and the show. It's been great to have you on. I got to say, I was quite intimidated, particularly your LinkedIn photograph. I was very worried as to how this was going to go. So I'm really glad that you are such a, you know, so willing to share all of your experience and your knowledge. I think it's going to help anyone, you know, who can actually connect with it.
So I know I definitely do. No doubt. Glad to be on your show.